Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, Brian Diaz here. Thanks for listening to the NOLA Drink Show, friends. Happy to have you here. Got a really good show coming up for you, and we're going to bounce right to our featured interview in just a second. I'll tell you about that in just a second. Looks like next time around, we're going to be bringing you our part two, if we harken back all the way to April of, I think 2019. Sure. We took a look at the wines of Georgia, the country, of course, the cradle of winemaking on our planet. And we're going to be bringing you a follow-up show to that, where I think we're going to take a little bit of a deeper dive. That's the plan as it stands right now. We'll let you know more, of course. But this show is a really fantastic one. I've been wanting to do this for a while. We are talking about shochu, the Japanese distillate, certainly not to be confused with sake or beer or wine or anything else, Japanese whiskey. This is its own category of distillate, can actually be made from many, many different things. Some of the more common ones are barley, sweet potato, rice, and brown sugar, but there are tens, if not dozens more, of starches that you can actually use to produce shochu. And it's a super interesting story. It's been around for centuries. There's, as you're probably gathering by what I was talking about, from which you can make it, there is a huge world of it out there. And here in the United States, we're starting to scratch the surface just a little bit more of what's available. Of course, one can imagine that more of it is available in places where, you know, there's more of a Japanese population, like in New Orleans, which we don't have so much of here, unfortunately. You probably see a little bit more in those places. But we're starting to see more on the market in general because bartenders are becoming more interested in it. I think the general public's becoming more interested in it. But it's a huge world of this really interesting distillate, and it is absolutely fantastic most of the time. And so we touched on this. We did a show about 4 years ago, I want to say, where we did a couple segments on shochu. But we're taking a much, much deeper dive, and our two guests are Christopher Pellegrini and Stephen Lyman. Both are authors. Christopher has penned a fantastic book, The Shochu Handbook. A really good, useful guide, talks a lot about shochu, some producers, things like that. Just, you know, a lot of what you need to know about shochu. Really cool book. And then Stephen co-authored a book, The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks. So it covers sake, shochu, whiskey, beer, wine, cocktails, a lot of grown wine stuff going on there in Japan, by the way. But it's a beautiful, beautiful volume, and it talks a lot about drinking culture, alcohol culture in Japan, more than being a straight guidebook to shochu, which the touchstone there is really Christopher's book. So it's a real honor to have both of them on, both Christopher and Stephen, and those two have collaborated on a shochu portfolio called Hankaku Spirits. And they're looking to bring in, and are bringing in, I should say, and it's growing into which markets they're doing so, but bring in more shochu into the United States. And so we talk about what shochu is, what it isn't, some of its history, how it's made. Our podcast only segment, if you're listening on the radio, go to noladrinks.com, which it'll be out shortly. We take a much deeper dive. We taste through some expressions. We talk about them. We talk about their books. It's just a really fascinating, fascinating conversation about a fascinating and fascinating spirit. So that's our featured interview, friends, and we're doing this over Zoom because those guys are in Japan. Actually, two American guys, but they live in Japan. So, we're going to bounce right over to our featured interview right after the other side of this break, friends. So come on back to the NOLA Drink Show.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans.
I wonder why my baby drinks so much wine. If she keeps a drinking, she's gonna lose her mind. She's a wine-head woman, don't you know? She's a wine-head woman, don't you know? I hate to do it, but I just got to let her go.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the program, friends. Happy to have you here, as always. And yeah, as you know, we are talking about one of my very favorite distillates, shochu, which is an indigenous Japanese spirit. And I'm pleased to be joined by my guests, which you also know because I teed this up in the first segment, Christopher Pellegrini. Christopher, how are you?
Hello, Brian. Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for we're taping this. It's Monday evening here in New Orleans, Tuesday morning there in Japan. So thanks for waking up and being a part of the show.
110%, my pleasure.
Thank you. And also Stephen Lyman. Stephen, how are you?
Doing very well. Thank you, Brian.
And I will express the same sentiments to you. Thank you for getting up with a cup of coffee. I told you guys that you guys are having coffee. I'm about to pour some shochu, so you'll have to kind of guide me through this. I know that you've tasted everything I'm going to taste before, so you don't have to have it in your glass to walk me through. But you guys, so shochu, I mentioned this in the opening segment before we started here. It's such a fascinating category, and as we were talking about off-air a little bit, more and more people are becoming familiar with it in the States and in Western Europe and things like that, because it's, you know, it's being exported more. People are discovering the category, and rightfully so. It is a huge world, and there is a huge variation out there. So you may know one or two expressions or have heard of it, but don't maybe have a grasp of the, as I said, the breadth of what's out there. So we're going to talk about that today, but can you guys give me, in this segment here, we have, you know, several minutes to get into this. It's also a centuries old distillate in Japan. And can we kind of start with sort of the history of it and maybe tell people what it is and what it is not? Because there's a lot of misconceptions out there about what it is and what it is not as well. And I'll throw that to either one of you, whoever wants to jump in there.
Sure. I guess I'll take that since I'm the history guy.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. You have an undergraduate degree in history, Stephen. Please. Thank you.
That's right. So distillation really spread around the world during the Age of Discovery. It was really that time when, you know, international trade started up and you had these, you know, these ships circumnavigating the globe and that sort of thing. And that's around the time when distillation technology spread throughout the world. And that's around the time it came to Japan, as best we can tell. And it's not clear exactly how it got here. We do know that it likely arrived in Okinawa before Japan, and because they were an independent country at that time. And that either came through trade with China or trade with Siam, which is modern day Thailand. And then whether or not it went from Okinawa to Japan or came through Korea, it is unclear, but distillation was really starting up in all of those places around the same time. And
Stephen, so we're like 16th century, is that right? Ballpark?
Yeah, we're looking we're guessing late 1400s is probably when it arrives. I guess late 15th century.
Gotcha.
And then the Japanese obviously had their own indigenous alcohol tradition, which is sake. And they'd been making that for hundreds and hundreds of years at a very high quality before distillation arrived. So the belief is that the early shochu was distilled sake or some variant of that,
which would make
because they had the fermentation methods, so they could simply distill and get a higher proof alcohol out of the sake than they would get just from brewing.
That makes a ton of sense. And you touched on this, and this is not necessarily meant to be a super in-depth history lesson, but I know there are competing theories. The one that I had been most exposed to was the Siam theory of, because of the long grain Thai rice being used, and then the stills. I think a lot of the stills are similar to the stills used in Thailand during that time. Do you guys have like a gut impression on which one? If you had to wager money, what would you say? I know it's a tough question, but
I'd put my nickel down on Korea just because it's proximally so close to Kyushu, which is where most shochu is made today. Mm-hmm. And there was a robust trade between fishermen, between Korea and Japan. But there's every reason that it could have been Okinawa as well, you know, up through the Ryukyu Kingdom, as it was known at the time. But the reason I'd say possibly Korea is a stronger case is black koji did not come with distillation, and black koji is what's used to make awamori, Okinawan traditional distilled spirit. Now it's entirely possible the Japanese didn't need black koji because they already had their own variation.
Okay.
But that's just my own supposition. Christopher may have a different point
of
view.
Sure. I'm just curious because I know the jury's out on it, but what do you think, Christopher?
Yeah, I'm still kind of on the southern route just because the amount of trade was so robust at that time. And it wasn't just Thailand. It was a whole combination of countries and cultures that were being funneled through that pipeline. And the ports in Ryukyu were kind of the eastern or maybe the southeastern fulcrum of that entire net of ships going back and forth. And I think just the volume and also some of the information that we see about evidence of distillates showing up in Ryukyu, basically probably, and there's no hard evidence, but at least mid 1400s. And then it's 1460s when there's documentary evidence, I believe. And so I think it kind of, there, for me anyways, it seems just the pure volume is maybe going to lean it a little bit further to the south. But, you know, there's no way to know. We'll never know. Doesn't matter. It probably was nearly simultaneous. The point being that we had distillation practices, people doing this at home to a certain extent, occurring in several parts of what is now southern Japan.
Okay. Yeah. And I think that's a great point, right? This could have all been sort of a synergy or synergistic effect between the whole thing. Well, do me a favor, Christopher, tell people, and this is, we're not talking about sake here, of course, today. We're talking about shochu today, but there's a lot of misconceptions on what these things are. Sake is not rice wine. We'll save that for another time. But can you tell people, what is shochu in its essence? We've talked about how it's a distillate, but please.
In its most basic sense, and we're talking about a legal definition here as well, shochu is a distillate made from approved ingredients and their koji, single distilled or in a pot still, and that's one run through a pot still, okay? And the result is generally something that hits the bottle at between, standard is 20 to 30%, 25 to 30% ABV. Now, when I say approved ingredients, we're talking about honkaku shochu, honkaku meaning authentic in Japanese. And there is actually a list of about four dozen plus approved ingredients, the major ones being sweet potato, rice, barley, buckwheat, and kokuto sugar. But there's a lot of other stuff that's permitted regionally around the country. And those are all used to make this incredibly diverse palette of aroma and flavor that today is known as shochu. And it's a, I think, as you hinted at before, a remarkably diverse spirit, perhaps the most diverse in the entire world.
It's really stunning on that level. And I was aware principally of the sweet potato, barley, rice, and buckwheat. I wasn't even aware of the brown sugar aspect of using it. And then when in going through your book, the Shochu Handbook, which is a very fine volume, when you said you have like this chart with something like 12 that you show, 12 approved, and we can't really call it produce because it's more than produce. We can't really call it grain because there's more than grains going on. Right. But, and then you said that's only like 1/5 of the list. And I'm like, tomato, bell pepper, hoa. I had no idea that the breadth of it was that great. And then when you start to talk about the, then mom and pop and different people making it, when you can vary your production methodology, it is a vast world.
It truly is. And that's thanks to the pot distillation and the fact that by law, you have to keep the ABV under 45%, which precludes you from a second run in a pot still, because you're going to naturally get up into the 50s and 60s there.
Right.
So it really is a what you have is what you get. You have to create a really delicious and aromatic fermentation, because you only get one go of it at the, in a pot still. There's no do-over. There's no, okay, well, we'll get it in post, as they say in the editing world,
right.
As I'm sure you're familiar with. It really has to, play well in that one run through the pot still, or else you're going to have something that's nigh on undrinkable.
Right. Okay. So almost like fair enough to maybe compare it to Pisco in that sense, right? Where you get
that's
one.
That's a great corollary.
Okay. Which actually makes a lot of sense too when we continue or consider the Japanese connection to Peru. But well, so back to the history thing. It was very interesting too, checking out your work, you guys, and understanding sort of the rise of shochu in Japan. Yes, it's been around for centuries in Japan, but seems to kind of have enjoyed, I'll say, a significant amount of growth within the country of Japan itself, really only in the past 40, 50 years, correct? You want to take that one, Stephen? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, shochu was a local blue-collar drink, much like bourbon was for a lot of its history, right? The major production region is in southern Japan, Kyushu Island, which is where I'm based, and then Okinawa, which is to the south of here. Now, Okinawa was an independent country for most of its history and only joined Japan much later. But there was a point at which southern Kyushu was the furthest you could get from Tokyo in Japan. This is before Hokkaido became part of Japan. So this is very remote Japan. And the locals were making their local drinks. And it was a lot. It was farmers and fishermen home distilling. It was not companies producing this. They were making it for themselves and their neighbors out of their excess agricultural products. And then it was only during the Meiji Restoration that the government, they realized this was something they could tax, and therefore they forced people who were home distilling to become companies and start paying tax revenue. But it really remained for another almost 100 years. The Meiji Restoration was around the 1880s or so, which is when all of these tax regulations came into being. It was only until the 1970s that you really didn't see it or think about it in other parts of Japan. And in the 1970s, the big innovation that led to shochu going national was vacuum distillation. Rather than using an atmospheric pot still, which gives you a full-on flavor and aroma bomb with all sorts of interesting character, a vacuum distillate is very light and clean and easy drinking. So much more aromatic than a vodka because of the single pot distillation, but on that end of the spectrum as far as being light and clean, where the atmospheric distillates are really robust, rich, deep, unctuous. And so that really ended up...
Think like funky Jamaican pot still rum, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
Yeah, yeah, versus your Bacardi White. Right? That's the corollary.
Right.
And Bacardi is a huge brand because it's clean and easy, right? So that was the first sort of wave of interest in shochu. And then there was another... there was a mini wave, which we'll ignore for now. And then there was a second wave when connoisseurs and drinks fans discovered how interesting the atmospheric distilled stuff could be. And this was in the early 2000s. And at that point in time, that's when you started to find shochu bars. You found shochu sommelier. You found a very strong interest in these much more robustly flavored drinks. And that is really continued. In fact, shochu now outsells sake in Japan and has since 2003.
Yeah, you guys were saying that, which I find that really, really fascinating in your work. I would have never guessed that. Does this kind of tie into you guys with sort of the rise of Japanese cocktail culture as it's being seen on the global stage? It seems to kind of tie in with the timing when you're talking about with early 2000s. And
it's interesting.
Okay, please. Yeah.
In Japan, you don't really find shochu on cocktail menus. If you go into a proper cocktail bar, you don't really see that. Now that is changing, but it's changing slowly. I think there's much more innovation in shochu cocktails happening overseas than there is domestically.
Interesting. So Japanese cocktail bars are still mimicking Western cocktail bars for the type of cocktails that they're making. Okay. That's really fascinating too, because we become so enamored in certain circles. We were talking about Tales the Cocktail. You guys and listeners of this show know it well. This is a fascination with Japanese cocktail culture, and it seems to kind of tie in with the rise of the cocktail renaissance in 1999, 2000 here, and that discovery. But that's really interesting that it doesn't have that kind of presence there. And is that because it's just sort of the work a man's kind of drink situation, and it hasn't penetrated there? Is that sort of why? Or is it because of borrowing just heavily from whiskey and scotch and everything else from Western distillates?
Most cocktail bars really do have that classic cocktail bar feeling with the tuxedo, the drinks made from Western spirits. It is changing. And one exception is Gen Yamamoto. And he is now making most of it. He does a cocktail course. It's a omakase, which is basically chef's choice or bartender's choice, where you make a reservation and you drink through several different cocktails over probably 90 minutes or so. And he's using shochu as the predominant spirit in those drinks. He's using all Japanese spirits predominantly as the base for these cocktails. And he's using seasonal ingredients to mix with. And that's what makes it so Japanese, because Japanese has this very strong seasonal cuisine.
Absolutely.
Tradition. And so he'll go to the farmer's market in the morning and pick the freshest fruits and the, whatever he thinks is best. And he'll create those cocktails that evening. And that's it. But that's so far removed from the standard cocktail culture in Japan.
Okay.
You guys, interesting thing about Gen Steven, is he actually learned to bartend.
Do me a favor. I'd like you to hold that thought. Can we take a quick break here and come back? Sure. And we're going to bounce right back in and hold that thought for me. All right, you guys. We're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show, friends. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in. We are chatting with shochu experts and American expats living in Japan, Stephen Lyman and Christopher Pellegrini. And Stephen, what happens in this show very often is we take these breaks and then we end up shooting the breeze for a long time in between the breaks, and then we forget what we were talking about. But you were on an interesting thought, so we took a really quick break. So please continue what you were talking about with the cocktail culture in Japan.
Sure, no worries. I just wanted to finish a thought about Gen Yamamoto. Uh-huh. What's interesting about him, his cocktail bar is in Tokyo, but he learned to bartend in New York City.
Right.
And he took that experience back to Japan, and he was freed from the Japanese cocktail culture because he wasn't part of that world. He could be much more creative coming back to Japan. And then he decided he wanted to make cocktails with Japanese spirits. And so he really is, I think, on the cutting edge in using shochu as a base spirit for cocktails in Japan.
Okay, awesome.
There's another bartender, very famous bartender internationally in the same vein, but much more recent. His name is Shingo Gokang, who also was a very well-regarded bartender. We can bring the name Bacardi back into the conversation because he was the Bacardi World Bartender of the Year back in the early 2010s. And he has since opened a bunch of bars across this part of the world. And they are always in the top 50 bars in the world or in Asia every year at that competition. And he has a line of his own shochu now. So he's kind of doing a similar thing where he's using Japanese spirits in a more Western context. And he does some remarkable stuff at one of his new bars in Shibuya, which is called the Bellevue. He actually has a chef in there in this private little booth who does an omakase sushi pairing with cocktails, and it's shochu based cocktails. Really, really fascinating stuff. Diverse flavor profiles, again, really delicious and very no holds barred. There's sushi that is influenced by Mexican cuisine and by Middle Eastern cuisine, and then you've got a cocktail that's a riff on the gari, the pickled ginger that is there as a flavor palate cleanser.
Yeah, sure.
It's 1 hour. It's rather quick. It's kind of an in-between stop before you're on to the next place. You get, it's like 8 to 10 pieces of sushi, a couple of cocktails. Fascinating stuff. And this is just the beginning, I feel. And shochu really is going to start to flex in this space.
That's really interesting and very cool to hear. Christopher, let me ask you this. What are we seeing as far as the export market goes? And I mean, we can pick the United States because it's probably, you know, easiest where most of our audience is. And we were talking about this, you guys, before we went on the air. I grew up in California, as listeners know. I was exposed to shochu because we had a big Japanese population in the San Francisco Bay Area. Not widely exposed to it, but exposed to it. Here in New Orleans, we don't have a big Japanese population. So more of the vector of it is through bars. And then the occasional Asian market maybe stocks 5, 6, 7, 8 SKUs. But are we seeing it on a global stage grow and seeing that breadth be ever so slightly more represented?
I'm grinning because Stephen and I are up to our necks in the export market. So
I knew you guys were the guys to ask. Yeah.
Thank you for opening the door. We'll walk through this one at the same time, shoulder to shoulder, I think. I don't even know where to start. Stephen, you probably have a better way of summarizing the way things have changed, especially because you lived in the States a little bit more recently than me.
Well, I think what we've seen is that most shochu that's been imported into the States has been imported by Japanese food companies. These are companies that are importing rice, soy sauce, miso, seaweed, you know, all the different things that you need to run a Japanese restaurant. And by the way, they also import sake and shochu. And because sake is really taken off, shochu's sort of been left in the warehouse. And they really sell it in a pretty traditionally Japanese way, which is to Japanese restaurants. And so there isn't really much to there isn't really much entry into mainstream American bars or restaurants or liquor stores. So it's really been a niche product for a long time. That's starting to change as we have some export only brands that have started to come in. There's Mizu Shochu, for example, from Saga Prefecture. They've got some nice expressions and they come in at a higher proof. Christopher mentioned most shochus, 20 to 30% alcohol, 25 being the standard. Mizu comes in at 35%. Mm-hmm. So it's going to hold up a little bit more in a cocktail. A couple of really nice aromatic expressions. They have a lemongrass version. They have a green tea version. And then some of this, and almost everything that had been coming into the States for most of the time that shochu has been imported, which has now been over 40 or 50 years, has been from large producers. So the difference in scale and production is just, it's almost mind-boggling for the large producers versus the small. But now you're starting to see some of the small producers make entry through some of the more premium or craft distributors or mm-hmm. importers. So you're just starting to see some handmade shochu come in, some stuff that's hard to find in other parts of Japan outside of Kyushu. So it's beginning, but I don't think the sales have necessarily followed at this point. I think it's still pretty flat. Where it does seem to be gaining some traction is in Europe.
Okay.
There have been a number, and what they're doing on that end is bringing in actually undiluted shochu. So then you're up in the 40 to 45% alcohol range, and you're right in that sweet spot for cocktails.
Okay. Got you. Yeah, what we're seeing here, at least in this particular market in New Orleans, is Mizu is the Mizu
yes.
Is kind of dominating the space. I mean, that's what you're seeing on back bars and a couple of their flavored expressions, and then their regular expression, and that's really about it. And then a few Asian markets that'll carry a handful of SKUs. So I think people have a different association with it than they would maybe some other spirit. So thank you for clarifying that, because do we think it's going to, is the vector to grow and diversify what we're getting here in the market here? Is that going to be a bartender thing and a craft cocktail thing? Or is it going to be a combination of that and Japanese restaurants maybe also being able to diversify what it is that they have? And yeah. I want to separate this question really quickly, because we're not talking about strip mall Japanese restaurants. I think that's a different animal, to be honest.
Sure. Well, it's funny, the best shochu selection I've seen in New Orleans was at N7, which is a French restaurant, but the chef's Japanese.
Yeah, right.
And so very, very nice shochu list there. And she'll show you how shochu can pair with her French food, right? So there's, and that's where I really think the shochu has two avenues as far as on-premise. It's going to be cocktail bars and not necessarily just Japanese restaurants, but restaurants with drinks pairing menus. Shochu at low proof can actually slot right in into a food tasting menu with a wine pairing. So I think that's another avenue. And I do know a number of chefs who have experimented with that in New York City.
Okay.
Where they've had shochu right in there with the sake and the white wine and the red wine.
Got it. You guys got about a minute left before we take another break. Christopher, are we seeing with the export stuff, and I think we've kind of touched on this, but so is the export market being dominated more by higher proof stuff to play nicer in cocktails? Because I'm noticing what I see is, as you mentioned, Stephen, that I'm seeing 35 kind of percent is typical of what I do see on shelves here and on back bars.
I think if you go and look through some of the larger importers in the States, if you look through their catalog, you're actually going to see an average ABV that mirrors more of what is standard in the Japanese market, or at least that was true up until a couple of years ago. It's starting to climb, though, and that's something that we are assisting with. I think you'll find when you look and taste through our portfolio to kind of see what's coming next or later on in the recording, there is absolutely a little bit of upward lift on ABVs.
Okay, gotcha. Let's do this, guys. Let's take another break. And I will note to listeners that you guys are sticking around for our podcast only segment, Another Shot with Nola Drinks. And we're going to do a little more tasting and talk a little bit more about distillation methodology and some things like that during that segment. But in the meantime, we're going to take a brief pause here on the Nola Drinks Show, friends. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Happy to have you here, friends, on the Nola Drinks Show. Yeah, we are talking about one of my favorite distillates. I think I said that before. Shochu coming out of Japan. We are chatting with Christopher Pellegrini and Stephen Lyman, who were kind enough to wake up and be awake with me here because it's Tuesday morning in Japan and Monday evening here as we tape. But guys, thanks again for making time. And we've talked, we've touched on the history and we've touched on some of the aspects of the different ingredients that you can use. We're going to get further into the weeds there in the podcast only segment, but you guys have a portfolio that I think, and we've kind of teed all this up, have a portfolio that is going to continue to introduce us to the broad world of shochu. And so why don't you tell us about Hankaku spirits, please? And whoever wants, Christopher, you want to take that one, man? Or sure, Steven, yeah. Whoever, either one. Toss up, boys.
Yeah. Well, we'll both jump in here. I think we're pretty good at kind of it's almost like ice hockey, you know, line shift type of thing.
Yeah, beautiful line shift. And I'm a crappy interviewer, so I'm just throwing it out there. You guys, whoever wants to pick up the question.
Okay, I'll chase the puck first. So we started Honkaku Spirits in the middle of the pandemic. Actually, we touched off. Game started right in March of last year, so we're a little over a year old. We are a full-service import outfit in that basically what we do is we try to make it very easy for our friends in the shochu and awamori industry to agree to slice off a portion of their very small production capacity and send it to a market that they have no idea about. We do the design work. We do all of the sourcing of packaging materials. We send it kind of as a shipment straight to the distillery. They fill everything up. They tape all the boxes. They put it on a pallet and they ship it where we ask them to. And then we work on all of the branding, the marketing, and the account activation on the U.S. side. We're very, very hands-on. And we consistently have meetings with our suppliers. Like I said, Stephen and I, to give a little more information on this, we've been friends with a lot of these people for, you know, combined going on 3 decades. And it's just been in the last couple of years where we've started to say, hey, I think we can take this further afield. What do you think? And it's been a real collaboration in that sense. We now have our first container of product that will be released into the market pretty widely across the states starting from June of this year. Is a 7 main SKUs, 9 in total, that will be here and there. And I think Stephen can probably jump in with a bit more detail about what people have or what people should be looking for on the shelves of their local retailer.
Can I ask you a really quick question first, Christopher, since you brought it up, and Stephen, before you elaborate on what Christopher said, and I was remiss in asking this question earlier, I apologize. What is the difference for people who want to know between shochu and awamori?
Great question. Awamori is shochu's uncle. It's a little bit older, technically, possibly. We're not exactly sure how much older, but awamori is more strictly defined than shochu. You can't use the dozens of ingredients. There is one main starch source for making awamori, and that is rice. It has to be made with rice, and it has to be made with black koji. Similar to shochu, though, pretty much everything else is, well, many other things are similar. It's a single pot distillation. One slight difference is that it's really, all of the rice has to be kojified rice. It has to have koji propagated onto it. We're getting into the weeds a little bit here, so I'm going to defer.
We're going
to
do that to the next
podcast,
segment. Yeah, sure.
I think.
Cool. Yeah.
Yep. But it's a more strictly defined type of shochu, you can almost say. Shochu itself tends to be way more diverse.
So different starches, whereas awamori's key is that it's rice only. Okay, gotcha.
That's the key point.
Gotcha. Stephen, and continue on what Christopher was saying, please.
Sure. With the portfolio that we've developed, we've really tried to fill gaps in what we know is currently being imported into the States. We really looked for styles or expressions that simply do not exist in the American market, because we don't really need to bring in another 25% alcohol sweet potato shochu because there are dozens of them available. We need to bring in a foolproof sweet potato shochu, or we need a 30%. We need something that's been blended, because blending is a new thing happening in the sweet potato shochu world. And so we were trying to bring in things that are unique to the American market, but also hard to find here. And so we have a few things that are extremely limited. As Christopher mentioned, we have two brands that they're basically going to be unicorns. If you find a bottle, consider yourself lucky, because there's just so little of it even available in Japan and far less available in the US. Sure. And then also we've tried to, Mizu did, is we're trying to bring in higher proof spirits. And really what Christopher and I spent a lot of time doing was tasting different dilutions of the raw distilled that we knew we wanted to bring in, and finding the sweet spot. What's the ABV at which it expresses itself best? And that was often 35%, which is interesting, because normally in Japan, you jump from 25% to 35%. There isn't a whole bunch of 30%.
Okay.
So it was interesting that we often found 35% to be the most expressive.
That kind of nice sweet spot right there. Okay. Very interesting. And we'll be sharing some stuff on our show notes and things like that. You guys, do me a favor, tell people too. I'm going to hold these up just because we might get some visuals out of this. Show and Tell, the Shochu Handbook there by Christopher. And then the Japanese Drinks book, A Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks by Stephen Lyman. And Stephen, you had a partner in this book as well. Chris Bunting, tell us very briefly, guys, about a minute each, thereabouts, 30 seconds each, about the books and where do we find them, importantly.
Sure. Since you mentioned mine first, I'll start. It's the Shochu Handbook is available exclusively on Amazon. And so therefore you pretty much everyone's going to have access to it if they so desire. It's a real introduction to the category. The category is such a rabbit hole that the 200 pages don't really do it true service. However, if you just want to know how shochu and awamori are unique, how they are really not some trendy new thing out of Japan, but have hundreds and hundreds of years of history, and how they are such culture bound products, and also how they really are born of a culture that eats and drinks at the same time, then maybe it's a good starting point for people, for your listeners, Brian.
Yeah, absolutely, Christopher. It's a very good book that gives very nice background, shares some select producers, talks about styles, talks about regions. Stephen, what about the book, which is a lovely volume, The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks?
Oh, thank you. That is intended to really give an overview of alcohol traditions in Japan. And this is, it's broken in the first half is on Japanese alcohol, native alcohols. So sake, shochu, awamori, and fruit liqueurs, or like we think of plum wine. It's not, again, it's not a wine. As you said, sake is not rice wine. Umeshu is not plum wine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's actually fruit soaked in distilled alcohol. That's the first half. The second half gets into Western, Japanese interpretations of Western alcohols. So whiskey, beer, wine, and then cocktail culture as well. Yeah. And that's really the book in a nutshell.
It's a beautiful volume. And actually, I really like the section on cocktails, because it kind of touches on what we were talking about earlier and how the scene is changing in Japan. I think even how the influence is coming back in this direction and stuff like that here in the Western world. You guys, we've got about a minute left before we close out. Tell people where we can close out the portion of the radio show. Where can we find information about Honkaku Spirits? Website and Instagram and all that good stuff. Either one of you. Go ahead, Christopher.
Go ahead, Christopher. Okay. So if you check Honkaku Spirits, that is currently in a bit of a state of genesis. It's going to be rapidly updating over the next couple of months. So it should be a great place, a good resource as well, to check back, learn more about Koji and how it is incorporated into the drinks culture of Japan. Also, our portfolio as it develops and as it unfolds in various markets, you'll be able to go on there, learn about these makers, learn about the story behind. For instance, we have a master brewer distiller who also happens to be a professional musician, and she also happens to be one of the youngest Toji, as we would say in Japanese, the master brewer distiller in the entire industry. So it's going to be a resource, honkaku spirits.com. That's H-O-N-K-A-K-U spirits.com.
Awesome. And Instagram, easy to find that way too, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, you guys. And also we have the Japan Distilled podcast at Japan Distilled on social media.
Yeah.
And japandistilled.com.
Awesome. And we're going to share it. We'll talk about that in the next segment, and that'll all be in our show notes, friends. If you are listening on the radio, go to NoelDrinks.com, get the podcast. And I do appreciate you being here, friends. Remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all. Everybody, up another shot with Noel Drinks. Thanks for listening in. Thanks for sticking around, friends. What a fascinating conversation about shochu, the indigenous Japanese spirit. We are going to bounce right back over to our conversation with Christopher and Steven and keep talking about it. Here we go. Yep, another shot with Noel Drinks. Thanks, everybody, for listening and sticking around. We're chatting with Christopher and Steven, two shochu experts and owners of a fine shochu portfolio, Honkaku Spirits, and we teed that up for you just a little bit ago. And we're going to taste some stuff here right now. Let me ask this question, actually, Christopher, of you. I think a lot of people maybe know what it is. Tell people, like, in a brief version, what is Koji? Because that's such an important part of this conversation.
Koji is Japan's national mold. M-O-L-D, I did not mispronounce malt. It is one of the most important ingredients in Japanese cuisine. Without it, you don't have mirin, you don't have sake, you don't have shochu, of course, or aomori, and you don't have miso. You wouldn't have soy sauce if we didn't have this very important sacrificing agent. What koji does, this mold does, is it sends feeding tubes into whatever starch source it's been propagated on, and those feeding tubes excrete a couple of key enzymes that act as giant scissors and chop complex starch chains into simple soluble sugars such as glucose. And this is a very basic and a very natural, it was a wild process that's been happening for millennia in Japan. It's been domesticated and leveraged by the drinks industry for hundreds and hundreds of years. And one of the results of that, and the reason why we're here today, is shochu.
Yeah. Cheers. Kanpai. Thank you for that. Thank you for that explanation. I appreciate that. I am tasting, you guys, right now, a very fascinating, this was one of those sort of mind-blowing expressions to me as we touched on the breadth and the diversity of shochu, of what is out there. There is of what I have been sent by you guys, no finer example of the poster child of blowing my mind of the breadth of shochu out there is the Mugi, do I say Mugi Oka? Is that?
Okay. Mihoka, yeah.
Okay, my rusty Korean is almost passable to translate into some poor attempt at Japanese. So tell us about this one, guys.
Sure. Mugihoka is a 100% barley shochu made by Tensei Distillery on the southern coast of Kagoshima in southern Kyushu. And as I said, it's 100% barley, but 8% of the mash bill is roasted barley rather than steamed barley, which is the standard way of doing this. The barley used in shochu production is actually pearled or polished barley, not the whole grain like you would use for whiskey or beer.
Okay.
So that polishing allows the koji to infiltrate, and it gives you a cleaner expression than you would get from an unpolished barley.
Okay.
In whiskey. A new make whiskey can be pretty rough even after a second distillation run.
Sure.
Where a single distillation of pearled barley can be quite lovely right out of the still.
Go ahead, please.
And so Mugihoka, what makes it unique is that 8% roasted barley in the mash bill, and which just gives you those really interesting coffee and dark chocolate notes, which are so unusual in a distillate.
It's incredible. And actually, I think, as I said, it's sort of this poster child kind of thing that I think it, if I may, it typifies the example of what we're talking about, of the diversity of what's out there in the shochu world, because this is a choice in production, right? So we're using what can be used here. That's, and then the 8% roasted barley is a way to, I hate to use this term, I guess, but customize the expression. And that is, I think it's such a great example of what we're talking about here, about the huge world of shochu that's out there. So thank you for Christopher actually suggesting that we start with this one in the tasting, because it really is kind of getting to the core of one of the things that I really wanted to talk about on this program. It's really fascinating stuff. That's great. So you guys, with the distillation methodologies, well, actually, you know what? I want to ask you this question, because one of the things that I found interesting looking at some of the notes and such, we're so used in the Western world, we're so used to clear distillates being unaged, right? Because that's kind of the idea. Sure. And what we're seeing here is I'm looking at these things and they are clear as day, but I'm aged 8 years, aged 11 years, aged 16 years, and some ceramic aging and enamel aging. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because that's also really, really fascinating. They're not brown. They're clear, but they're aged. Christopher,
that's right.
Yeah, or Stephen, either one of you, please.
I'll take this maybe, because I'm a big fan of aged shochu. I think Christopher actually likes it right off the still. He doesn't want to wait for it to
take to that gas tube off. Put it right in my esophagus. right.
Keg stands right on the shochu still. Right on, man. Go ahead, Stephen. Yeah.
Yeah. No worries. So, going way back to the history again, ceramic pots were used for shochu production. In fact, a lot of smaller distillers still use these ceramic pots that are hundreds of years old, buried in the distillery floor. Being buried like that helps maintain temperature for the fermentation, and also makes it easier for the staff to stir the pots. And that convection helps the koji breathe and agitates the yeast and helps give us these flavors and aromas that we really like. Those pots can also be used for aging. Now, these are unglazed ceramic pots, so they breathe. You know, you get some oxidization, you get UV rays that are changing the character of the spirit in these pots. Now, if you leave it in the pot too much, for too long, you end up with a very strong minerality that almost becomes bitter.
Okay.
And so what some distilleries will do is they'll leave them in the pots for a few years and they'll move them to an inert tank, which is usually an enamel lined stainless tank. And that is a more controlled environment. You can lock that tight and you have less angel share evaporation. And so we have a trio of products, Motoko, Masako, and Mahoko, all from Fudusawa Distillery in Miyazaki. There's a rice expression, a barley expression, and a sweet potato expression. And all of those are aged in that way. They're aged in ceramic and then moved to enamel.
Okay. Two questions. Is there any need to filter after any of that situation? Or there we go. We're getting that on a little. We'll get a still of that, Christopher, here. And okay, we'll screenshot that, man. Does anybody filter at a certain point, or is there really no need for that coming off the ceramic pots?
There is filtration. It's usually just before bottling. There will be some light filtration in during aging. The oils, the organic oils that come through on a single distillation will rise to the surface.
Okay.
And often those will be skimmed off the top because if those oils go rancid, obviously you have a problem.
Right.
But often those tanks will be mixed about once every month or so just to get those oils back in. But then anything that seems to have just started to dry on the top will just be taken away. And then you'll go through anything from a rough filtration to a chill filtration at the end. So there are different options for filtration. Most of what we're bringing in, again, from these small distilleries is very lightly filtered.
Okay, cool. I'm going to ask you another question here in just a second, but what should I pour myself next? And then I'll ask you the question while I pour, if that works. So this is professional drinking hour here on the NOLA Drink Show.
We have time constraints, so this kind of supercharges the approach to this, doesn't it, Stephen?
Yes, it does.
It does. Perhaps Masako?
Masako? Okay. Next. Let's do that. So
go from barley to barley.
Let's go to barley to barley. Okay, Mahoko. Let's go. Yeah. Masako. Here we go. Got it. All right. So, well, go ahead and tell me about this one, guys, first.
So this is 100% barley as well. And it is, this is aged in ceramic, which is part of the reason I suggested it, I believe 11 years. And this, again, is from the Furusawa Distillery. And it's a very, very different expression from Mugihoka.
Oh, absolutely. I get sort of a pear and a little bit of white stone fruit kind of thing going on here. Absolutely. Wow. So you guys, you were talking about, and here's my question. We were talking about blending, and I've had a few expressions typically, Stephen, as you mentioned, the ones that I recall that I've had have either been rice as the predominant ingredient or sweet potato as a predominant ingredient. Has blending been a really common thing, like say mom and pop operations, or has that always been a very common thing, or is that a very modern conception, both just, you know, historically as well as commercially?
Sure. So one of the first brands to go national, in fact, they were the largest brand until relatively recently, is Ichiko. And they are master blenders. I really call them like the Johnny Walker of shochu, because everything that they release is blended. But that's really the exception. Normally, a distillery will make a single style, and they might add new distillate to the same tank, but it's made in the same style. So they've kept the recipe. The production methods are identical. Only very recently, we started to see intentional blending of two different distillates by smaller makers. It's not that common in the industry, but it's starting to change.
So is that because like small production, and we talked about how it was families making stuff, they maybe grew one thing on the family farm, so that's what you distilled, and that's kind of that monostarch or monograin consideration. Is that a fair assumption as to why that's the case?
I think so. And year over year, you're going to have different quality of ingredients. So putting new distillate into an old tank helps maintain consistency.
Right.
You know, you've got some distillate from last year left over. You're putting some new distillate into it. But there is variation in how these small makers express year over year.
Okay.
And so we are planning on bringing in vintages of some of these, where it will treat it like wine. Where you'll have the 2020, you'll have the 2021, the 2022 on down the road.
And thank you for bringing that up, Stephen. And Christopher, maybe I'll ask you this question, because I know you touched on it in your book. So there are protected appellations, if you will, or protected name statements on shochu. So it is recognized about where it can be produced and what can be used. So like wine and like rum agricole or any number of other things that we're talking about here like that. So is that a fairly new, I'm going to ask you a two-part question. Is that a fairly new iteration or legal aspect of what's coming out of Japan? And then I'm going to ask you, go ahead and answer that one first, if you don't mind.
Sure. It's an application process, I suppose, with the WTO and their intellectual property. I don't know what the process involves entirely, but over the past 20 years, we've seen four different GIs, or geographical indications, be granted to indigenous spirits from Japan, one of them being Ryukyu Aomori, which is the rice-based spirit from Okinawa. And then you have three that are centered in Kyushu, the home of Honkaku Shochu. One of them is a sweet potato spirit called Satsuma Shochu. We have a rice and barley being the main ingredient, or the larger of the two ingredients, from a small island called Iki, that's Iki Shochu. And then finally, a 100% rice distillate from Kumamoto called Kuma Shochu.
Okay. Now, vintage, naming vintages, is that part of the process, or is that kind of something that you guys are doing?
That's a much more recent phenomenon. And I think we've started to see a lot more, not a lot more, actually, I delete, not a lot more. There are a few small places that they have their own farmland. They've they've become very masochistic when they're not in the distillery doing this very difficult labor of creating delicious fermentations. They're out in the fields, they're harvesting, they're protecting their crops from wild boar, you know, basically. Right. And it's a full-time, year-long endeavor. And these places, especially in the sweet potato world, and I think we should move on to sweet potato next with our tasting.
Okay.
In the sweet potato world, you're dealing with a starch source that is in the ground. And this is pretty rare in the world of spirits. This is something, if you want to get into that very touchy subject of terroir, I think that sweet potato shochu is a really easy place to have that discussion, because this, the tubers are really being affected by what's surrounding them. They spend their entire lives underground, and then they spend a matter of hours above ground before they are whisked off to the distillery, cleaned, cut, and put in the steamer, and then shredded and sent and added to the secondary fermentation. It's a really, really interesting category because of that. This is a living, breathing thing. It's something that is going to change based on how much rain was received in May. It is something that's going to be different from year to year based on, hell, how much ash dropped into the soil from that angry volcano next door, which is called Sakurajima, one of the most active volcanoes in the world. It's a really dynamic type of distillate, a spirit. And that's why we thought, well, why are we not recognizing that this is very much in and of the season when it was produced? Because it is going to be different next year.
That's really, really interesting. Kind of, and we touched on this, Christopher, before talking about Pisco, because we're talking about a single distillation. So right. That terroir is going to pop more in a single distillation than it would be if you're quadruple distilling potatoes for some vodka or something
exactly.
like that. Really interesting. So what should I move to sweet potato, guys? What should I pour myself here?
Steven, it's got to be colorful, right?
I think so.
All right.
Yeah.
Got it. Boom. Right there. All right. So tell me about this one, fellas.
Well, this I'm going to let Steven field this because this is a blended one that he was talking about before.
That's right. So this is also from Miyazaki. Actually, right down the road from Furusawa Distillery is Shoro Distillery down on the southern coast of Miyazaki, about as far south as you can go in Miyazaki before you're back into Kagoshima. And this is a blend of two different distillates made by two different master distillers at the same distillery, made from the same kind of sweet potato grown on two different farms in two different years.
Okay. Yeah, so, and actually there was a significant gap in years, if I remember reading the notes, right?
That's right. It's 2016 and 2019.
Okay.
Blend. So everything in the glass is at least 2 years old, but some of it's 5 years old.
This is also a really lovely expression. And again, I get this very nice pear note. There's a very nice earthy note to this. This is lovely. This is actually this one was, as I mentioned to you guys, I was tasting a little bit earlier, and this might be my favorite, I think, of the ones that I tasted. I mean, just because it is so expressive, and it's not shy. And I mean this in a very good way. It's all, and I'll say this to you guys too. Every one of the expressions of yours that I've tasted here are remarkably clean, which is really interesting. And, you know, because like you guys mentioned this, we sort of expect like the Mizu is very kind of hot and nothing wrong with it. But, and then some of the lower ABV ones, these are all very, very, very clean expressions. So the finish is almost, it's almost like water. And I mean that in a very good way, not in a bad way. It's not flawed. It hangs for a while, but it's just, they're all really clean. And there's a nice acidity to all of them. You guys have done a really good job with picking what you do.
Thank you. Some of them, of course, are things that we worked with the distillery to develop, but most of our portfolio are Japan domestic products that we went out and picked. We picked them just because they're things that Steven and I drink in our living rooms, or actually I drink in my booze closets. Steven drinks in his office.
I was noticing behind you that you've got your down jackets and your bottles, man. So
that's right. these are my Swallows jackets.
Oh, you got it.
I got a whole collection of those to support the local team. And we really picked the ones that we would be really proud to show off for a couple of reasons. Number one, some of these are so hard to get your hands on. I can't even get them in Tokyo, and I'm only a 2-hour flight from where they're made. So the fact that we're able to share them with people in the States, obviously it's going to be a small group of people because there's not much volume, sure. But people who really want to try something interesting, they want to try something traditional from Japan, but as you said, something that is very, very well made, then, well, I think we might have a couple of answers for that quest. There's a couple of destinations here, things that you can really come back to a few times and just be like, wow, for instance, colorful. You're going to notice something a little different from it every time you open it up. These spirits are really interesting because they are kind, they're filtered in a non-mechanical way, I guess, in many instances. You're talking about, and there are some surprising ways to do this. I think this is another podcast, but it really is super light filtration, just to the extent necessary, meaning that these spirits sometimes need to be decanted. And I don't know how common that is. When you open the bottle for the first time, you're just getting, you're getting the distillery air, that last little blast, and then you're just getting all of this story and this history and the place. And sometimes that needs it needs a second to kind of stretch, get the kinks out of its shoulders, and then start to settle and decide what it's going to be. And it's a fascinating experience every time.
It's amazing. And thank you for saying that. I like talking on this program about terroir driven spirits when I can. And I mentioned Pisco. Mezcal, of course, is a favorite, and Shochu is no different. And so this is why I really wanted to do the show with you guys, because I want to, expose people to the breadth of what's out there, and what you guys are doing is fascinating and delicious, by the way, as well. Well, I know we got to get you guys, you got another meet. It's Tuesday morning, so you're kicking off your business day. I'm going to fill up here in just a second and just continue my Monday evening, because that's what we do here in New Orleans on a Monday.
Nice.
Yeah. Do me a favor, you guys, tell us another time about the books, and tell us about connecting with Honkaku Spirits online and all that good stuff. How do we find you guys?
Great. Stephen Lyman, author of The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks, which can be found all around the country in bookstores and online, Amazon and elsewhere. And you can find me on social at Japan Distilled, which is one word, I guess, you know, jammed all together. And that's for our podcast, Japan Distilled Podcast, which we launched in December. And we go through anything distilled in Japan. It's not just shochu and awamori, but we've had episodes on whiskey, on rum. We're planning a gin episode, just talking about Japanese distillates generally. And I run those social media accounts, so you can reach out to me there.
Okay, perfect. Awesome. Christopher, please.
Christopher Pellegrini, author of The Shochu Handbook, which was published in 2014. And is a good starter guide to get your head around these very, very complicated categories, just because there are so many different types and so many different expressions, and they're all called shochu, and it's a pretty bewildering experience, especially when you're just getting started out. But you can find The Shochu Handbook again on Amazon, and you can find me at some variation of my name on a number of social networking sites. Chris Pellegrini on Twitter. Pellegrini is Pellegrini. And then Christopher Pellegrini elsewhere. That's Facebook and Instagram. And much like Steven, who also can be found at shochu_danji, D-A-N-J-I, we're very responsive on all of these platforms. And we love a good conversation about Japan's indigenous spirits, also how they are similar to, different from, other traditions from around the world. We get very nerdy. So if you're the nerdy type, the geeky type, you like to get into the nuts and bolts of things, then you definitely are going to want to hit us up with any pressing questions that you might have.
So let me extract a promise from you. Oh, Stephen, go ahead, please. Yeah,
just a reminder, if you'd like to learn more about our portfolio in the very near future, www.honkakuspirits.com will be a resource for all things shochu and awamori.
Awesome.
That's right.
And so will you guys come back on the show and we'll talk about other stuff? We'll talk about baseball. How about that?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
That would be fun. We didn't even get there. So, yeah, cool. You guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Let's get you off to your meeting. And friends, brief musical interlude, and I'll be back to close things out.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Noah Drinks. Thanks for listening into the Noah Drinks Show this time around, friends. Always a pleasure to have you here. Hope you enjoyed that conversation about Shochu with Stephen and Christopher. Both great books, The Shochu Handbook and The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks. You can get them on Amazon. Check out our show notes. We got links right there to go get the books. Such a terrific spirit. And I had, you know, as you gathered from the conversation, I'm sure, I had no idea the breadth of starches that you can actually use. And so therefore, the different flavors, the different expressions of shochu, just how broad they are. And it's very exciting that those guys with their portfolio, Honkaku Spirits, are looking to broaden our shochu horizons here in the United States, bring in different expressions, bring in some of the smaller, more unique producers and all that kind of stuff. It's all very, very exciting. I really love shochu. I've really been into it for a good while now. It's one of those distillates, friends, that it reminds me of Pisco, Mezcal. There's many, many other examples, but it's just so reflective of the terroir, both the ecological aspects of the terroir and the cultural, the human aspects of the terroir. Shochu is just right up there for me in that category where you're drinking a bit of culture. You're drinking terroir every time you have a sip of that very fine distillate. And we, as I just mentioned, you know, thanks to Honkaku Spirits and others, we're starting to see more in the States. It's allowing us to explore this terrific, very, very broad category at a much greater level. So it's all very exciting stuff. It's a very exciting time to be a shochu drinker in the West, I think. Got a good show coming up for you next time around. We're going to be taking another deep dive into the wines of Georgia, the country, of course, the birthplace of wine. We did a show about a year ago-ish where we talked a lot about the history. We talked a lot about the production methodologies that are used there, traditional production methodologies, really interesting stuff. Go back to our website. I believe it was April 2020. Check that out. We also kind of focused on the main wine producing portion of the country, which is the eastern portion of the country. This time around, we're going to focus on the western portion of the country. Really fascinating stuff. A lot of small producers, just delicious, fantastic wines. So really looking forward to bringing you that. And we kind of wanted to treat it almost as like a sequel, if you will, to that first one. So we'll be sharing the link to the first one when we put the second show out on that country and their wines. So you can kind of hear them both back to back. I think it's a good way to do it. If you haven't heard the first one, it'll put things in context. So that's what's happening next time around on the Noah Drink Show, friends. Take care of yourselves out there. That's our parting shot. Here's to you. All these sciences, all these sinners will try.